Hello and welcome to the No BS Approach to Motherhood podcast, hosted by Catherine Hay and Shelley McKenzie. We are both mothers and clinical nutritionists who specialize in women's health. We are here to not only bring you the most up-to-date nutritional and health advice when it comes to fertility, pregnancy, postpartum, and children's nutrition, but our main goal is to break through the BS that can come with motherhood. No topic is off limits, so grab a cuppa or a glass of wine and join us for another raw and real conversation surrounding motherhood. This week's episode is proudly sponsored by Eye of Horus, a luxury, cruelty-free Australian brand thoughtfully designed in Byron Bay. Eye of Horus is committed to offering premium cosmetics that are clean, conscious, and considered. Cappy, you introduced me to this brand when I was staying at your house and you insisted I try it, and I'm so glad you did.
It is honestly the best, and I love all of the Eye of Horus products. I've been using them for such a long time because I'm extremely conscious of the chemical load that I put on my body because I have endometriosis. Eye of Horus avoid unnecessary chemicals and synthetic ingredients, which can disrupt hormones, cause irritation, and toxic buildup within the body. The clean, natural foundations also let your skin breathe, which is so important, especially for someone like me who has experienced adult acne.
Yeah, for sure. And some cool things about the brand are with every purchase, you earn points to redeem as future discounts. Eye of Horus also give back with every sale. So a dollar is donated to the charity of your choice via iChange. And if you're keen to check them out, follow the links in our show notes and on social media. But for now, let's jump into this week's episode. Today, we are diving into endometriosis a little bit more. We've done an episode, which I'll link into the show notes, which was going into the basics, I'm going to say, and I guess endo from a Chinese herbalist perspective. But today, Cappy, I'm going to be predominantly interviewing you about this with questions that have been written into our Instagram, because you have had both the personal experience with endometriosis being diagnosed, and you're going to share your story a little bit more, but also the professional experience as well, having seen many clients in your personal clinic. So start us off with your story and how you were diagnosed with endo.
Yeah, so it's taken me a long time to get diagnosed with endometriosis. I only was diagnosed with endometriosis in 2022, and I feel like I've had endometriosis probably since I was a teenager or in my early 20s. So you can see how long that time has been. So I totally vouched for myself. So I went in after giving birth to Sunny, my periods drastically changed. I always suffered from intense period pain, always, all my life. I have had absolutely chronic period pain that I always had to manage with pain relief every single month. I also was a huge sufferer of IBS, and we'll get into those links when we go into what is endometriosis later. So I had a lot of textbook endo signs and symptoms. So it wasn't until I gave birth to Sunny and my period started returning postpartum that I experienced really heavy blood loss every month with the excruciating pain. So I advocated for myself. I went to my GP, said, I'm not leaving here until you give me a referral for a gynecologist who specializes in endo because I want a laparoscopy. I just had decided right there and then enough was enough. And in 2022, I met with a specialist here on the Gold Coast. He said, yes, you tick a lot of signs and symptoms, did an internal ultrasound. And the way my, I guess, cervix was positioned, it looked like endometrial-like tissue had attached to part of this and was drawing my cervix to the left. So he said, I definitely think there is potential that you have endometriosis. Gold standing of endometriosis diagnosis is a laparoscopy. So within quite a short period of time, I was booked in for my first laparoscopy, had my laparoscopy, and was diagnosed with prolific stage 4 endometriosis, which just confirmed everything. It was like a huge weight was lifted off my shoulders because I was like, okay, this makes sense. This makes sense as to why I would feel the way I would feel every month of my cycle, especially around my bleed. I had endometriosis-like lesions attached to my bladder, bowel, pouch of Douglas, cervix, you name it. It was everywhere. So after I had that diagnosis, obviously shifted a lot within my physical health, you know, lifestyle, everything, because this is a disease that you can't cure, essentially. And again, I'm using that in air quotes. You can't cure endometriosis. It is like an autoimmune disease. It is not, but it is like an autoimmune disease. So with endometriosis, it's a lot about management. In my stories yesterday, I said prevention. I don't know why I said prevention in there when I was putting a question box out to my followers, because there's stuff we can do from a prevention perspective to help prevent lesions from growing back, but it's never going to prevent the disease from, I guess, being in your body, essentially, if that makes sense. So I had my endometriosis diagnosis, and yeah, that has led me into obviously a lot of research into it. I support many, many, many people in my clinic who have endometriosis, because it's never really been a topic of, well, a disease that's had much funding too, which it's one of the leading most painful diseases that we have, alongside obviously other painful diseases, but it drastically impacts a person's physical health, mental health, and day-to-day living, which is huge. And one in 10 are diagnosed with endo, but I think that is just recently changed now to even potentially one in 7 or something like that, because wow, it is so underdiagnosed. That's the thing. So they usually say it affects 10% of females of reproductive age. It can affect men, so I don't want a gender stereotype here. It can affect every sex. Estimated to affect about 190 million people worldwide, but that is thought to be a significant underestimation because of these amounts of time, like amount of time it takes for someone to be actually diagnosed with endo, because it is so brushed off in the conventional medicine system. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the key symptoms. You mentioned your really heavy bleeds and painful periods. What are some symptoms that somebody would be looking out for with endo?
Yeah. So common, I guess, clinical features of endo is, yes, pain. Pain is one, but then you can have silent endometriosis too with no pain. Heavy menstrual bleeding is another common sign and symptom. Pelvic pain with sex, so actually with penetration. Infertility, but again, you know, people with endo can conceive naturally too. Constipation and diarrhea are huge, and IBS are a clinical feature. Depression, anxiety, fatigue, all of those emotional and mental health disturbances are really common. Painful urination, pain when using your bowels. So you can get a lot of people experience shooting rectum pain actually with bowel motions and or, again, urination as well. So they are the most common, but again, a lot of people who experience infertility who go and have further investigations who present with none of these signs and symptoms go through a laparoscopy, and then all of a sudden they've been diagnosed with endometriosis. So it's a really interesting disease in how it can manifest for some people and completely different for others.
Absolutely. I actually have a client who's been trying to advocate for herself for quite a while, and she's a year into her fertility journey, finally got the laparoscopy and silent endo.
Yeah. So incredibly common.
So tell us, if somebody suspects, if they're like, oh, I've got some of those symptoms, how then do they go and get investigations and advocate for yourself? Like, that is tough to do sometimes in the Western world.
Absolutely. I just want to say on the endometriosis infertility picture just quickly. So I've got some stats here because I find it really interesting. So 20 to 50% of people who menstruate presenting to fertility clinics are shown to have endometriosis.
Huge.
20 to 50%.
Massive.
Symptomatic or asymptomatic, you know, and that is monumental part of that, like that piece of that puzzle for someone who's trying to conceive. And I think about my own story too. So it took me 11, 12 months to conceive with Sunny, and I would have had stage 4 endometriosis through that whole journey. And I had no idea at that time. So you can only imagine how many people who probably do conceive but also have endometriosis. And then you've got the other side of the coin, who people who are experiencing infertility and then go and have a laparoscopy and then are shocked when they get that diagnosis as well. So I find it's a disease that needs so much more research because there are so many unknowns as well. But I just wanted to say that with the fertility thing, because I know we'll have a lot of people listening in around fertility. So I just wanted to mention those stats as well.
It's massive. And we are going to also do an episode on postpartum periods, because like yours, Cappy, yours was picked up in that postpartum period, like many other disease and conditions are picked up in that postpartum period. So we'll also do something for that stage if you're listening to this and you're there as well. Yeah. But for now, tell us, so how does somebody advocate for themselves in the Western world, and what do they need to get tested to have a diagnosis? What procedures?
I think advocating for yourself really comes down to just wholeheartedly going into your GP, and hopefully you have a good relationship with your GP and saying something is not right. And again, I don't want to gender stereotype here, but I can't help myself. I find more commonly that male GPs will dismiss a woman's pain because they have absolutely no idea what pain feels like with menstruation. So there is no understanding of, you know, pain thresholds and things like that. So if you are seeing a male GP and you are getting nowhere with that male GP and you've been back 4 times, I actually uploaded this stat onto my Instagram last night. Let me just get it up, because it's point in case. It is absolutely timely for this chat that we're having. Let me just get it up just quickly here. The reason women statistically frequent the doctor more than men is that we have to go a minimum of 4 times before they believe we have a real problem.
Disgusting.
Isn't it?
It really is.
And when it comes to reproductive health, a lot of this is just completely dismissed. So I think finding a female GP, unless you have an incredible male GP, that's fantastic as well, who can sympathize and empathize a little bit with the female reproductive health is really important. You are in your right, though, to say to your GP, I am not walking away until you give me a referral for an endometriosis specialist if you suspect you have endometriosis. They have to do that for you based on all your signs and symptoms if you are going in and you are symptomatic. And it's hard to stay in your power in those situations because GPs can rip that power away from you really quickly. And again, I'm not saying this about all GPs, so please don't come at me. It's just a generalization here. Advocating for yourself is the hardest part, right? It's the hardest part because we trust the medical system to advocate for us also. But a lot of the times we are dismissed. So advocating for yourself, saying to your GP, you're not going to walk away without a referral to a specialist, I think is really important. Finding the right types of specialists are also really important. There are endo specialists, They're what they call endo cowboys out there that are just so happy to put you under the knife and do a really awful job of removing endometriosis like lesions, and can do different methods of laparoscopy as well. So I think, again, you want to have maybe had a discussion with someone who has specialized in endo, so you've got all of that information behind you when you're going into those appointments. What method do you use for extraction of the lesions? Is it ablation? Is it excision surgery? You know, what other investigations can we do before you have a laparoscopy? Where did they train? How are they an endo specialist? And again, I'm using that in air quotes because any gynae can call themselves an endo specialist, but actually, you know, how they perform their surgery is quite appalling compared to someone who actually is an endo specialist. So definitely worthwhile doing a lot of research and doing your homework there so you feel prepared in those situations.
Cappy, just quickly, no doubt as well, there is probably Facebook groups and endo groups and things like that that you can get into and start asking questions, because word of mouth is always amazing. Like, I hope you don't mind me saying, but you went to one endo specialist and now you're about to see your second one next week through word of mouth and somebody else because you weren't happy with the original, you know, everything that went on the first time. You feel like there's still a missing piece.
Yeah.
And so now you're going and seeing somebody else. So, you know, jumping into maybe Facebook groups and talking to other people about who they should go and see could be really helpful. And I just want to say, you know, we always say this on this podcast, we are not here to GP bash, but I think it's really important to note that a GP is a general practitioner. They specialize in a little bit about a lot of things. And so stand your power because your symptoms are your symptoms and they are telling you what, like your body is telling you everything you need to know. And you just have to be the one to hold that power. Only you know how you're feeling, right? And so just remember that, a general practitioner specializes in a little of a lot of things.
Exactly. And Endometriosis Australia is a great one. They have a lot of different resources on their website, or you find a healthcare practitioner like myself. There are so many out there that have specialized in endometriosis who can give you those resources and tools as well. So
for sure.
I think, what did you say then that really, I was going to go on a tangent about it, but now I can't remember. It'll come back to me.
And so I've got...
I remember. So also, if you're not happy with your specialist, you don't have to follow, you don't have to go through with it too. So this is what happened with me. I had my laparoscopy. I was happy with my specialist at the time, but my signs and symptoms did not improve, right, for a very long time. I'll speak about my signs and symptoms later, but I was still experiencing, you know, a lot of pain. So in my gut, I still feel like there is that missing link, which you just explained, Shelley. So now I have seen a new endo specialist through word of mouth, through practitioners up here on the Gold Coast too, who recommend this woman. And I'm booked in for surgery next Friday, not for a laparoscopy, but for a tube flush and to have a camera in my uterus, hysteroscopy, to look to see if there's any polyps, if there's anything else going on before I have to maybe potentially look at having another laparoscopy. So just know, shop around. You don't take your car to the same mechanic if they do a crappy job. Same with your health. If you're not happy and you're dissatisfied with the service, shop around, do your research, find a new GP, find a new specialist who will advocate for you also.
Yeah. And Cappy, can you also talk to us about the laparoscopy and your recovery? Because it was something that you had underestimated and it was a big deal. And so can you actually talk us through if somebody is preparing for a laparoscopy and that aftermath as well of post laparoscopy, what should they know and what can they do to recover? Or, you know, what recommendations can you give us?
And this is a really good one because I did totally underestimate my recovery because, again, everyone is so different. Some people, you know, have minor intervention during a laparoscopy and recover quite quickly. People like myself who had major intervention, I took a lot longer to recover as well. So you kind of go into a laparoscopy not knowing what's going to happen on the other side, but still you're having keyhole surgery, you're potentially having excision surgery as well, and you're under a general anesthetic. So I only took a week off work. That was not enough for me. I minimum would have liked to have had 10 days off work. And that's what I do recommend to my clients coming through is take 10 days. Mm. It took me a couple of days to actually wean off the opioids. And it was the most horrendous drug withdrawal I've ever experienced. I hated every minute of that. It was a really out-of-body experience because I was in so much pain. I also stayed in overnight and had that option with the hospital. I did go private. I have private health, so that's what I chose to do. And anyone that can have that option, I highly recommend having that extra care overnight. You have basically they fill your abdomen with a gas, and that gas, when you come out of surgery, you have to let that gas dissipate over time. You can get shoulder tip pain. You're feeling really inflamed. And there's a lot of bleeding that can happen. And I had a catheter in, you know, I had all of these things in that there was no way I was walking out of that hospital the same day of that procedure. I was extremely unwell and in monumental pain as well. So I stayed in overnight, which was really great for that extra support. And then I couldn't lift anything. I couldn't get out of bed. You've had abdominal surgery. Yes, it's keyhole, but it still took me a long time to recover. You're still dealing with that shoulder tip pain, and how it's a stranger sensation, but it feels like a really tightening in your chest. So it feels like you can't breathe. So you're really waiting for all that gas to leave your body, and that can take a couple of days too. So it's really setting yourself up. It's having a support team around you after surgery, post-surgery. It's really focusing on easy to digest foods and beverages, because we want to give your gut the partially broken down food, because there's obviously so much trauma to the abdomen and the actual uterus and around the uterus itself. Depending on the types of medication that you're on, or if you need antibiotics or opioids and the rest of it, you want to come off those. I do suggest sooner rather than later to let your body go through, if it does go through a withdrawal. And that's where that was really hard for me. But you also, I had a toddler at the time. There's no way I could have taken care of Sunny. So I had my mum here, I had Nick. I couldn't lift anything, I couldn't carry her. I was literally in bed for the first 4 days. We do encourage people to walk around and get moving, because that again helps that gas dissipate throughout the body. But I found it awfully challenging. I found it awfully painful, and it did take me a long time to heal. So again, if you can set yourself up for post-laparoscopy support, a lot of nutrients like collagen. There's an incredible product I recommend post-surgery for anyone called Repair-Aids. We're really working on the tissue healing and wound healing and uterus support, all the rest of it post laparoscopy, especially if you're coming in for infertility. I think it's a big one that we can do so much work in those early stages to give you the best recovery and healing to help to prevent as much scar tissue as possible as well. So, obviously,
So,
yeah.
oh, sorry, go on.
No, you go.
So, I was just going to say perhaps in the lead up to a laparoscopy, preparing for the worst and hoping for the best
Absolutely.
is, yeah. And even in terms of food and stuff, like everything that you've just explained is essentially what we want to eat postpartum. So, even looking at some postpartum meal services and delivery services that you can get and just have your freezer stocked, they're all those kind of meal services for your postpartum are full of your collagen, your bone broth. They're all slow cooked, they're easy to digest foods. So, definitely we can link some below as well that you can check out too.
Yeah, and things like, peppermint tea, all your teas, really restorative and healing. And that again can help with the shoulder tip pain. But you're bleeding too. That's the other thing. You're bleeding. So you want to have good period care support too. And you don't want to wear anything high-waisted, because you've got incisions there. So you actually want low-waisted and really light dresses or nighties over even tracky pants or pajamas, because you don't want the band anywhere near your central abdomen or even just below, because of where the incisions are made. So super low rise or actual big t-shirts or dresses is going to be most comfortable whilst you still have your stitches in too.
And so let's then go back to endo, whether somebody's had surgery or not. What would be some diet and lifestyle recommendations for managing? We've got a couple of questions here. It says, does anyone actually ever heal it? I feel slightly defeated. And there was another question, supplements that can help, foods you can avoid. Can you dive into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, and this is a thing with endo, because everyone's going to have their version of their signs and symptoms and how that impacts you. That people can be impacted by endo and pain every single day of your cycle. So just know there is no right or wrong answer to any of these. And I'm just going to talk, let's talk from my personal experience. And then I'll bring in my clinical experience and what I obviously know about the disease too, just to give it. Give all, I'll try and give as many different options, across the spectrum as possible. So, I totally, I've got so much empathy and sympathize for you when you feel defeated. I have been there. I feel that, I have months where I feel the same. And this is where it depends how hard you want to go with supporting yourself with endometriosis. So you could be completely doing everything by the book, removal of all endocrine disruptors in the home. That's a big one for endo. You know, we want to remove those, and we've got a whole episode about this. So I'll leave that for that episode. You know, there are different food groups that can help manage endometriosis, but this can change. For instance, for myself, I'll bring it back for me. I avoid all gluten and all cow's dairy. That works really well for me because of my IBS signs and symptoms as well. And that has drastically helped other areas of my body in terms of inflammation. Has it helped the period pain? Hard to know because I still get it. So I don't know if there's a direct link there with the actual some of my endo symptoms, but it's drastically helped the IBS, which is associated with endometriosis as well. There's a lot of clinical evidence for gluten-free and cow dairy-free. And there's also a lot of evidence for low FODMAP diet. So this is the thing, though. Low FODMAP diet is such a huge range of foods, which we would never want to avoid for a long period of time. So this is where we always want to bring it back to IBS and do you have IBS signs and symptoms that are associated with your endometriosis? So you must be on this diet for endo. In my clinic, from clinical experience and the research that I have read, majority of my clients respond really well to gluten-free and dairy-free, just period. Yeah. Because they can be very inflammatory in the body, you know? So that is, I think, majority speaking, but not for everyone too. So I have never put an endo client on low FODMAP diet, never done that because I don't see the point, because we get into the gut microbiome and I can get into that later. But low FODMAP generally means there's a gut microbiome issue, not so much that's causing the endo signs and symptoms. Does that make sense? Another thing, you know, alcohol, caffeine, stress, all of these will exacerbate endometriosis as well. So I definitely haven't cut out alcohol from my diet. I love a drink. I love a glass of wine. It brings me joy. I do it with friends and socialize. I have definitely reduced my alcohol intake, I guess, throughout the week sometimes, but other times, like, you know, the holidays, for instance, I had a drink every single day. So I am not a purist too. So this is the other thing. When people are feeling deflated with endo, it depends how hard you want to go. What are you prepared to sacrifice, but then also potentially gain back in terms of managing your endometriosis? So for me, I'm not completely low tox, because that doesn't always bring me joy. I still have my coffees. I still have my alcohol, because that's part of a lifestyle that I want to live. Like, that's my choice. So I know so many people who have endometriosis, have zero signs and symptoms, who are completely thriving, but don't touch anything inflammatory, low grain, low lectin, low nightshade, no alcohol, no coffee, no gluten, no dairy, you know, none of these things. And that is so, so fine. I think that's incredible if that's the avenue and the route you want to go to help manage your endo, and maybe even be in that, I guess, and I'm using this like air quotes, prevention stage for lesions potentially growing back. But that doesn't work for everyone. You know, I think it's about finding that happy medium or on that spectrum. How can we reduce your signs and symptoms and manage the disease that also fits in with you and your lifestyle and how you want to show up every day as well?
Which is really important, because stress management is a big part of endo as well. And so going too far down the route of cutting everything out and it causing anxiety when you're eating out with friends and family and you're losing that social connectedness and all of those kind of things, and that is impacting those stress levels, which also impacts the endo. So it's kind of like working out where your happy medium is without also falling, like going complete purist, but that be a challenge for you for other reasons.
Exactly. And this is why I don't believe there is one single diet that is going to work for everyone with endometriosis. I don't.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm just looking at questions. We've answered most of them. Anything else that you're wanting to add in that you feel like would be beneficial or that people should know about who are endo sufferers?
I think the gut Endolymph is truly something that can't be ignored. So when you look at a lot of the research, it suggests a low FODMAP. It's because there's dysbiosis within the gut. And a little bit of research is starting to come out now that there is pathogenic bacteria that has shown to be linked to endometriosis as well. The uterus has its own microbiome and so does the gut. So there's definitely a translocation here of bacteria happening. So every single endo client that comes into my clinic that can afford it, I will do a gut microbiome test, because really supporting the gut, estrogen excretion, estrogen metabolism is super important. And we've got to start at the epicenter and the excretion part of the gut. We need to make sure we're excreting our sex hormones properly. And we want to make sure we've got a really good, nourished gut microbiome. So starting with the gut is absolutely fundamental to many people with endometriosis. And again, it's not just going, I've got endo, I'll try low FODMAP, remove all these foods, don't really see an improvement with signs and symptoms, because you're not repopulating and flourishing that gut microbiome in terms of diversity. So that's why I'm very much, if we can have as many foods in the diet with endo that is supportive and get a reduction in signs and symptoms, that is my absolute goal. And I utilize a lot of supplements with my endo clients and myself. I'm on an absolute concoction because it works. You know, I was saying to Shelley off air, I had my best period last month, and it's because of everything that I've been doing and consistently be doing. But this is the thing with endo is too, we can have some pain-free cycles and then all of a sudden get a really full-on endo flare. And that's just normal of the disease. It's not like, oh, this isn't working, or you have to put that pressure on yourself and be like, I'm not doing a good enough job, I just had a really bad cycle. That is just the nature of the disease. And we have to be okay with that as it ebbs and flows as well. So I always say to my clients, I want to maximize your nutrition and your nourishment as much as we possibly can with what's going on with your gut, what's going on with your hormones, because estrogen is a driver here of endo as well. We can't ignore that most endo people are powerhouses at making estrogen, and these lesions also create their own hormones through a process called aromatase, which I'm not going to go into because it's too sciencey. But it's this thing where we have to be constantly working on hormone excretion, proper hormone metabolism by the liver. So a liver is a key organ here that we're also really supporting as well. And simple things here with it, your estrogen detoxification, your Christmas veggies. So this is really interesting, right? I'm saying let's increase all your cauliflowers, your broccolis, your Brussels sprouts, your kale. Now, if with someone with a dysbiotic gut who hasn't done any gut work, they're probably going to react to a lot of those vegetables, right? So this is the thing why we always start with the gut. Then we can work on estrogen detoxification by the liver. We've got phase one liver detoxification. We've got phase two. So we're working on the excretion of our estrogen metabolites via the liver. The liver kind of then packages them up into a less toxic form, so to speak, sends it to the gut. The gut then has to excrete them by feces. So it's a very, it's an all kind of staged, excretion pathway with endo. And that's why we are trying to assess estrogen exposure. That's really important. We want to assess aromatase activity. So testosterone, estrogen, how those hormones are being created, and if there are any imbalances here. And this is where we use different functional pathology. I am bringing it back to me for a minute. I recently did a estrogen genetic test. I actually don't offer this in clinic yet because I don't know much. I know a lot, but not enough where I want to bring it into clinic yet. I did this with my naturopath, and it was really interesting to see what genes I have for estrogen, I guess, dominance, using that in air quotes, for endo switched on, and what I don't have switched on. So switched on and switched off. So now knowing what my genes are, I'm actually on a way more tailored protocol to support my genetics with estrogen exposure and estrogen detoxification. And that's why in the last month I've had the best period I've ever had. Because,
so interesting.
Yeah, it's even like it's refined that even further for me. I'm going to do a lot more research into all of this myself, so I can make that a part of my clinic. but it's expensive and it's, you know, it's costly and it's all those other things. And that's another thing we have to factor in is the cost of endometriosis. I put all my clients on so many supplements. We see all of these beautiful improvements, but they can't afford to keep up with that too, which is so normal as well. So this is where I think if you've got a practitioner or someone that can kind of hold your hand and work with you with what's achievable, what's not achievable, is where you're going to see the best outcome for your endo as well. But don't give up. I think that's another thing. People are just so quick to throw in the towel because it's not working, again, in air quotes. It's a serious disease. It's a serious, serious disease. Yeah.
And this is where you were saying the low FODMAP, you know, all those beautiful foods that we bring in to support the liver and hormonal clearance are on that low FODMAP, sorry, on that high FODMAP list. So if you're on low FODMAP, you're told to cut out all of that. But I think there's this, you know, in clinic, I'm often trying to get people to a place where we use supplements to make them thrive. And if they can't afford it, we use foods. We bring foods in to maintain it for a period of time, and then we bring the supplements back in, right? But if you've cut out all those foods on a low FODMAP diet that help with that estrogen clearance and, you know, hormonal clearance and all of that, then it is going to be really hard for you to stop your supplements, continue eating the way you are, but then see results.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. So it's really figuring out where we can make those changes, what's going to be more beneficial for your lifestyle, and then bringing in supplements, because there are key supplements here for endo too that have shown incredible promise in the research. Things like PEA. PEA is incredible for the reduction of chronic pelvic pain, dysmenorrhea, so heavy pain for periods, and just that deep internal pain. I get really good response of PEA. Turmeric, NAC, these are incredible for liver support and the hormone support as well with estrogen. Turmeric is obviously an anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, so that's obviously really incredible. But NAC is NAC for me, and acetylcysteine is a non-negotiable.
Yeah, I love it.
You know, it really helps to replenish glutathione. Glutathione is like our master antioxidant in the liver, but also found in every single cell of the body. So it's supporting with endo. It's a lot of oxidative and cellular damage. So we really want to make sure we've got a high antioxidant component to our diet, but also our supplements to, I guess, suppress that proliferation and excessive inflammation of those endometriosis like lesions that is what endo is.
And if you're in your fertility journey suffering from endo, NAC is just unbelievable,
game changer. And then I also got to mention, because this is in my routine as well, your omegas. We know they're anti-proliferative. We know they're anti-inflammatory. They are so incredible at reducing inflammatory cytokines, which are in our bloodstream. Vitamin E and vitamin C, also really beautiful. Vitamin E is something that was new into my, I guess, daily routine supplements, but it's really helped with decreasing, again, heavy menstrual bleeding and heavy menstrual pain. So they're really beautiful. What else do I use? Magnesium for stress and emotional well-being, but also progesterone. So again, tailored to the individual, very much understanding the individual case and looking at the supplements and then going, okay, this could be really beneficial for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that has been amazing. Thank you for sharing both your personal journey and so much clinical wisdom around endo. I think that's a really nice starting point for people to be able to, first off, learn the signs and symptoms, how to advocate for themselves, and then hopefully help with that management as well. But of course, they can reach out to us in our DMs, reach out to you in clinic too, Cappy. And you've got heaps of stuff on your Instagram, like heaps of reels and things like that as well, which we'll share around this episode on the No BS too, just so you can get a little bit more information and go from there.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. That way we can continue to inspire and reach more mamas around the globe. If you would like to get in contact, request a guest or topic, then head to the No BS Approach to Motherhood Instagram page and send us a direct message. Otherwise, until next episode, stay sane, Mama.